This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, this is Nuala McGovern, and you're listening to the Woman's Hour podcast. Hello, and welcome to Woman's Hour. Great to have your company. Today's guests have me thinking about different approaches to life. The WASPI women, that's the Women Against State Pension Inequality, could have as their motto, if at first you don't succeed, try and try again. That's because they have scored what some see as a major victory, fighting to win compensation for their members, as the Parliamentary and Health Service Ombudsman will review the report investigating changes to state pension age and also how it was communicated to them. It's been a long journey for them. Instead, for artist Alison Kinnard, her motto may be that rejection can be a blessing in disguise. A rejection from art school set Alison on her path to become one of the world's leading glass artists and also an influential Scottish harp musician, in case one is not enough. We're going to hear about how she turned that rejection around. And I want to hear if you also managed to do that, where you rejected and it turned out to be the best thing to ever happen to you. In any area of your life, I am all ears. You can text the programme. That number is 84844. Text charged at your standard message rate. On social media, we're at BBC Woman's Hour, or you can email us through our website. And if you'd like to send a voice note or a WhatsApp message, that number is 03700 100 444. But the text, 84844. Also with us this hour, young climate justice activist Michaela Loach. She's just written It's Not That Radical, which is her call to action. Maybe it's also her motto. We're going to find out. And we bring you another fascinating insight into narcissistic mothers. If you've been following that series, I most definitely have and find it just fascinating, I have to say, some of the stories that you are sharing and also just your insights on how you see it now, perhaps years later. But first, another victory for England's women's football team. The Lionesses will no longer wear white shorts as part of their kit. Now, the call was made by the team to create a darker set of shorts as players spoke out about concerns of playing during their periods. West Bromwich Albion, Stoke City and Manchester City football clubs have switched to darker shorts for their female teams. And it follows other sports that have also made the change. The All England Lawn Tennis and Croquet Club are expected to allow female players to wear dark underwear under their tennis whites. That's at Wimbledon for the first time this year. And the Irish women's rugby team will wear navy shorts at the Women's Six Nations. So how significant is this? What impact can it really have? Well, I'm delighted to be joined in studio by Fiona Thomas, sports reporter for the Daily Telegraph and number 11 on this year's Women's Hour Power List, which we revealed last week. That list recognised 30 women in the UK who've made a significant impact in the sporting world. You can, of course, listen back to that show on BBC Sounds or watch it on the Women's Hour webpage. Welcome, Fiona, and congratulations for placing on our power list.
Thank you so much. I was gobsmacked. It was a great honour.
Well, we're delighted that you're on it. We're delighted that you're here. Let's talk about these new kits. How significant do you think it is?
Do you know what? It's absolutely huge. Like what you just said there in your segment shows that this is a trend that's been happening across the female sporting landscape for, you know, a good 12 months now. And the news yesterday that the Lionesses are going to be ditching the white shorts, you know, in time for, this Thursday's match against Brazil, but also for this year's Football World Cup down in Australia and New Zealand, where they are favourites to go and win that, you know, it's massive.
So it feels massive, but also, I mean, some might say overdue. Why is it only happening now? We've been having periods for a very long time.
It's amazing, isn't it? It's bizarre when you think, you know, when any of us women are on our periods, you know, why would we pop into the office in white jeans? You know, it's exactly the same for those players. You know, why would you want to really wear white shorts when you're in your place of work, you're going out onto the football pitch? You know, if you're a sort of a heavy menstruating woman, the last thing you want to be stressing and worrying about is, you know, potentially bleeding through your kit. And, you know, it is extraordinary that it's taken this time and that we're only just chatting about this now in 2023.
There is also, which I was very interested in, I was like, I wonder, will they make them for the general public? New leak protection in the shorts as well.
Yeah, fascinating stuff. You know, this sort of, you know, this level of technology that we're now seeing in women's sport would have been totally unheard of, like even just 5 years ago, when you think back to, you know, British tennis player Heather Watson, when she first spoke about girl things after a defeat at the 2015 Australian Open. You know, it's extraordinary how far the conversation has changed.
Yeah. And I mean, are people talking openly as well about how periods can affect your performance? I'm often in awe of them, of being able to go out there. And I know you can perhaps try and control timings a little bit, but our bodies can be unpredictable.
Totally. And I feel that, you know, with the growing profile that women's sport is now enjoying, we saw that with the, you know, it kind of exploded after the London 2012 Olympics, the advent of, you know, social media. It's giving more female athletes a platform to kind of share their voice, share these issues. And, you know, if you go back to the Euros last summer, it was Beth Mead who I actually caught in the mix zone after England's opening game at Old Trafford. And, you know, periods and white kit had been in the news because of the Wimbledon stuff, and that there'd been protests happening outside the gates of the All England Club. So I said to Beth Mead, I said, you know, is it sort of practical, do you think, to be wearing this white kit? And to her credit, she said, well, no, it really isn't. At this time of the month, it can be a bit, you know, be a bit impractical. And she revealed that they'd fed that back to Nike, the kit manufacturer. And sometimes it just takes one person like Beth to speak up. And suddenly you see this domino effect. And, you know, more and more women have gradually started opening up about these issues.
Yeah. And when you think about that we became so accustomed to have been one way, and then that one person's action can make a change. We'll come to that with my next guest, Michaela, as well, when we talk about climate action. But, you know, as you talk about this, what are women telling you about their performance and periods, or how they're trying to, as we get this like leak protection, for example, in clothing, what else can be done?
I think, you know, the first and foremost, we need more data. We need more, you know, research into female athlete health. As recent as 2020, only 8% of sports science was dedicated to the female body. And of that 8%, a staggering 6% was only deemed credible enough to be used. So there's a huge gender data gap when it comes to female athlete health and sports science. And, you know, there's so much we still don't know about the menstrual cycle and how it impacts performance. You know, we know from kind of anecdotal reporting from female athletes, the small body of literature that there is out there, that it does tend to negatively impact athletic performance. You have examples like Dina Asher-Smith, the British sprinter who only a few months ago opened up about period cramps had derailed one of her races that she had to kind of pull out of. So there's still so much we don't know. And the sooner we kind of close that gender data gap, the better.
And you're making me think as well, of course, you've Dina Asher-Smith, you know, these amazing elite athletes. But we have also been talking, when we talk about women in sport, about keeping girls, particularly when they go into those teenage years in sport, and about the grassroots level and how important it is. And I'm wondering whether shorts with period leak protection, things like that, will become available.
Do you know what? It's fascinating, isn't it, to think that could be the future, you know, to sort of, you know, safeguard girls in PE more and help them enjoy that experience. You know, we all have experiences of teenage girls when we use our period to get out of school PE as an excuse.
Well, that's what kind of was coming to mind.
Yeah, we've all done it. I've been there. And, you know, if you look at cricket, for example, at test level, they still have to wear whites. And I think that will sort of have to be the case going forward because, you know, there's some sort of ruling around having to see the red test ball that they use at test level cricket. However, in age grade cricket now, we are seeing, you know, more cricket clubs across the country and in the community game, and, you know, allowing teenage girls and boys to wear coloured bottoms. So they do feel that bit more comfortable when they are on the cricket pitch.
And you touched on the lack of research there on women's health in sport as well. I know you write about women's health and women's sport, of course, extensively, and that's why you were on our power list. But you have talked about and thought about concussion for women and how it impacts women in sport. Tell our listeners a little bit about your work in that area.
Yeah, so I first started writing about female concussion in 2019, just completely by chance, I guess. And it was sort of fascinating what I was discovering, how, you know, female and male brains are wired differently. There is kind of a growing body of evidence to suggest that women do kind of experience more pronounced concussion symptoms compared to men. Their recovery is generally longer. And just going back to my point about the menstrual cycle, there is kind of some early research to suggest that a woman is more likely to experience a concussion in a contact sport in the second half of her menstrual cycle. And that's, I'm no scientist, but that's due to the sudden drop in the sex hormone progesterone. So, you know, that's just the tip of the iceberg. There's still so much that we just don't know. And like I said, it just goes back to the huge kind of data gap that exists at the moment.
And is that what interests you at the moment, or are there other areas as well that you
no,
want to explore?
No, I mean, there's that, and, you know, I've written about urinary stress incontinence, which we often talk about in the context of childbirth and women, postpartum women who've given birth vaginally. But that can, you know, absolutely impact certain athletes such as trampolinists, gymnastics, due to the amount of pressure that they're exerting through their pelvic floor. You know, that's a big issue. I remember writing about that, and we actually had loads of men comment on the story and said, hang on, this actually happens to me, you know, when I, you know, jump off the trampoline or whatever.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it was fascinating. Like, the story just really took off. It was crazy. breast injuries is another one. You know, that's, you know, they're really slipping under the radar in women's sport, because in a lot of contact sports, such as, you know, Women's Six Nations is happening at the minute, we'll use rugby as an example, we often use injury surveillance systems that are built for men, designed for men. We apply them to a women's context, and it's fine because, you know, it makes sense to do that because it's exactly the same sport, but they need a bit of rejigging because, you know, for guys, they might not, you know, breasts aren't in there. they won't have breast injuries. And, you know, there's a lot of research coming out of Australia, actually, at the minute, about breast injuries in sport. And I think there was some staggering statistic about, I think it was like 500 female athletes, 36% of them had reported experience of breast injury in a contact sport, but only, or less than 10% of them actually reported them to a medical or health professional.
Why do you think that is?
Because they're massively taboo still. You know, we're not, I guess, out of all the things that a sports person can injure, you know, you often think your ankle or your leg or whatever it might be.
Yeah.
But because breast injuries aren't deemed as time loss injuries, so, you know, you're not taken out of action because of a dodgy ankle or a dodgy knee, whatever, they aren't actually part of injury surveillance systems yet. But that there is early evidence to suggest that, you know, these women are playing on with kind of injured boobs and they can't move their arms properly or whatever it might be.
So interesting. Do you feel, we've covered quite a lot of ground there, do you feel hopeful about the direction women's sport and women's health in sport is going?
I do. I think you have to feel optimistic because I think the kind of dial has kind of changed even so much in a short space of time. You know, like I said earlier with Heather Watson, you know, first mentioning girl things in 2015, you know, now we have football teams at this year's Football World Cup with leak protection in their shorts. You know, the often, like, progress in women's sport can feel a bit glacial sometimes, but, you know, I am hopeful for the future, yeah.
So good to have you in, Fiona Thomas, who is one of the women on our power list. And if you missed that episode of our programme last Tuesday, you can find it on BBC Sounds. And you can actually watch the whole thing in full as we raise the roof. It is on the Woman's Hour page, which you can find there, and also clips of our number one woman, who is Leah Williamson, England's captain, who no doubt also helping her colleague Beth Mead in this respect as well. Thanks so much. Now, we cannot tackle the climate crisis without addressing social injustice. That's according to activist Michaela Loach in her new book. You might have already heard about Michaela as the climate justice campaigner from Woman's Hour, our planet power list. That was back in 2020. And she also took the government to court over fossil fuel tax breaks. It's Not That Radical is a guide to climate action that could benefit us all, as she says, starting with the people most affected. Good to have you in the studio, Michaela.
Thank
welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. Nice to be here in person.
Lovely to see you all in pink as well. I was hoping you'd turn up in pink. If anybody has followed you on Instagram or whatever, they might be used to seeing pink. Is it your favourite colour?
Absolutely. It's become a bit of an obsession, but it also makes secondhand shopping so much easier because I literally just go to the pink aisle and I don't look anything else.
And what is it about pink that you love?
I think it just feels like quite a happy colour. I feel like if I'm having a bad day, I just put on a pink outfit and it gives me power. I think that we've often thought of pink as this like soft, very femme colour, but I think there can be so much like strength in femininity as well.
Good.
Yeah, I've lent into that.
Good neon pink on the front cover of your book as well. And I should describe for our listeners, because it is radio, that you have pink glasses, kind of perspex, would that be fair?
Yeah,
thick frames and a pink jumpsuit. And I think pink Doc Martens,
did I see
at the bottom as well? Okay, and pink eyeshadow, I should say. So more liner, shall I say. Beautiful. Now, on your Instagram bio, coming back to that, you describe yourself as a climate justice activist, but also a soft black girl. So the first is no surprise, but why the second?
I think it's because in this world that kind of wants, especially people like me, especially black women in particular, to be hardened in order to kind of protect ourselves in a world that was not built for our benefit, I really want to hold on to the soft parts of myself. I think that we get told that like hardness is a strength, as if we should just not be fazed by anything. But I think that having a heart that's soft, so soft that it breaks the reality of the injustice in this world, is a strength, and that we shouldn't be wanting to be unfazed. I think we should be fazed by the things that happen in this world, and that that can be something that we transform into kind of action as well.
Do you find it hard to remain soft?
Yeah, I think so. I think that there's so much pressure, I think, put on so many of us to harden. And it is an active choice, I think, every day to remain soft to the things in this world. And by that softness, I more mean just being moved and not being rigid. I think that if I see injustice, I want to be moved by it. I want to cry. Like, I want to be hurt in some way so that I can actually transform that energy into something else that can change something about it.
But it's so interesting you say that, because I think, for many, I think my listeners might agree with me on this, that when there is an onslaught of news, particularly of bad news, you can become desensitized. Mm-hmm. And so then it's difficult to know where to start, how to make a change, how to have an impact. What spurred you to climate activism?
I really resonate with that. I think it can feel super, super overwhelming, and I don't want people to be desensitized, because that's, you know, doom and despair is not what we need right now. I think for me, I became quite passionate at first about migrant rights and migrant justice. So I think many people will remember, I think it was back in 2016, when the absolutely heartbreaking photo of Alan Kurdi, a 3-year-old Syrian boy, his body washed up on a beach in Greece, as his family just tried to seek safety. And when I saw that photograph, it really moved me. And I realised as well that I was also only 3 years old when I moved to the UK from Jamaica. But I was able to make that journey safely and easily because of the privilege of having a British father. So it's literally just luck of what we're born with and what privilege that is. And I realised that it was just, random luck that meant that I was able to move easily, whereas other people end up their bodies literally washing up on beaches. And all of that happens because of systems that are put in place in particular in the UK, our immigration system, and in Europe, our immigration system. And I think I felt so moved that I wanted to do something to try and change this issue. So at first I went to Calais and volunteered on the border with France and the UK, and just gave like material help, like chopping up vegetables and cooking food for people who were displaced there. And it was in Calais that I realised that changing the world is not actually this dramatically huge thing. It's lots of small actions that very ordinary people do every day.
Yeah, because I read that you're putting like a lifestyle perspective onto your climate activism. I mean, what does that mean? What are you calling for people to do in their everyday lives that won't inspire fear and doom, but give them a sense of purpose?
I think when it comes to climate, it's this huge, huge issue. And I think that so many of us feel confused about it because it's such a big issue that's impacting all of us in some way. But then we're told that what we should do is like change very, very small things in our lives to tackle it, which just feels like this huge disconnect. And I think that that leads us to this kind of anxiety or powerlessness, because there's obviously like a mismatch that's happening there. And so I think that when I talk about what we should do, I think it's about how can we actually change the systems that kind of have created a world where we have this kind of climate injustice, where we have this climate crisis, where people are insecure lives. And a way that we do that is by joining together in movements and in groups. And we do these things together and in greater campaigns. So it's not just about like blaming ourselves. It's about how can we work together to create change.
So you're talking, though, about, I know the book's called It's Not That Radical, but you are talking about radical reform, if I've understood properly. Maybe you'd like to set out your stall for our listeners of how you would see the world functioning ideally with institutions, what that would look like, or capitalism?
Well, so the title is kind of this like duality of the fact that in the mainstream media, we get told that climate action or that having a world where everyone gets to live in dignity is this like radical ask, in the definition kind of meaning ridiculous or really out there or impossible. And I think that we need to reframe what is really ridiculous. Like, I think it's ridiculous that currently we live in a world where the majority of people in this entire world are living in very insecure lives, and whereas there are literally a very, very, very small percentage of the world who are profiting off creating very insecure lives for the majority of people. And we should be outraged at those things and not at trying to create a world where we all live in safety and dignity. And also that this world where, when I say safety and dignity, I think the reason I say dignity is because I think that that kind of encompasses so many things. If you're living in dignity, you're able to have secure housing, you're able to have water and access to food, but also you're able to have joy and love in your life. And I think that that requires us to move away from our current economic system, which literally exists to just make as much profit as possible, and therefore it's kind of a race to the bottom and almost a competition of who can exploit more in order to make more profit, and that's what's prioritized. And I think instead we should have a world in which the lives that we're able to live is what we're prioritizing, rather than just profit being held in the hands of a few.
So it is sounding incredibly idealistic. Do you really think that a society could transform to that vision that you have within your lifetime? Now, I know you're young. Mm-hmm. I believe you're 25 years of age. But still, I mean, these are structures that are so ingrained. Do you expect to change capitalism on its head?
Yeah, otherwise, what am I doing? What am I doing if I don't believe that? And also, I think it's really important for us to challenge what we believe is possible, because I think that us believing these things are not possible is what's holding us back. Mm-hmm. And that there is actually a huge benefit of the status quo in making us believe that these things are impossible, that these are ridiculous demands, or that these are not possible at all. If we look at the past, how much has changed in our lifetimes? How much has changed in our grandparents' lifetimes? So many transformations have happened in society and in our world. And we must just continue to push for more and demand more. And I mean, I was living in Colombia during the last election there, and Colombia is a country that had 200 years of elite rule. So they had 200 years of uber capitalist, like Western kind of controlled governments that only kind of existed for the profits of a few and not for the many people in Colombia. And through the power of the people, so through like the people who are most marginalized in society, through the Black community in Colombia, through the indigenous community in Colombia and the working classes in Colombia, they came together and they said, we are going to transform this country. We are going to change everything. And now they managed to elect, after 200 years of elite rule, they now have a government which represents the people, where the vice president is Francia Marquez. She is an incredible Afro-Colombian woman. She's been an activist since she was 13 years old. She's the vice president of Colombia now. Gustavo Petro, who was an organizer and activist for his whole life. Those two people are now a part of a bigger movement that is leading that country. And that's only because of people coming together, and ordinary people as well.
And I suppose that is through democracy, right? That is through their voting system. Is that the path that you see for change?
I think that if we want to make these changes, they have to be democratic, in the sense that people have to be behind them. That's my perspective. But I think the way that we do that is to actually try and like really build power so that we can influence that system. So in Colombia, for example, they weren't waiting around or hoping for the existing kind of parties or existing systems to work for them. Instead, they were building power in their communities so that they could put pressure on, so that there would be popular support of a new Colombia and a new world.
Interesting. Also that thought from your book, a concept of the idea of people being good or bad is unhelpful. And I think it's an interesting one to think about when you talk about that intersectionality, be it about, you know, social justice or for immigration or people that are migrating or indeed climate action. Is there no good or bad people?
I think that my issue with this whole like good or bad or this kind of binary is if either everyone is either in the good zone or in the bad zone, is it just ignores the reality of the world. Like there's so much more nuance than that. I use an example in the book of like Winston Churchill, for example, is who I think is a very topical person because people either want to see him as wholly good or wholly bad, when the reality is that people have done a lot of different things. Yes, he was involved with winning the war effort in Europe, but he was also involved with a mass famine of six million people in India. And so and those two things can coexist at the same time. But I think we have this idea of historical figures that either they were wholly good or wholly bad. And that means that we look at ourselves and we are too scared of stepping out of either zone and being put into the bad zone, for example, and ousted from our community, that we don't even try and challenge what we think about the world or how we act. And I think that the world that we're building is dependent upon so many people changing their minds on things. And so we have to create, I think, environments where people are able to do that.
So do you think a fossil fuel company could be have parts of good in it as well?
I think that where that comes in is it's that I'm not saying we evade accountability at all. I think that that's while I'm saying, and I think also a company's not a person. That's another thing to, I think that too often we like personify companies. I mean, in the US Constitution, like companies are seen as having the same rights as people, which is completely ridiculous. But a fossil fuel company is not a person. And whilst there will be, I'm sure there are people in there that mean well, their impact that they're having is beyond grave. And I think that it's not about saying that they're right.
So you're very hopeful. You did take the government to court over subsidies paid to oil and gas companies, but lost. And I was more wondering with that aspect, what made you keep going or kind of where do you find your inspiration?
Well, I think in that case in particular, it was the fact that the government give like huge tax breaks to oil and gas companies and have given many public payments of our like public money that should be being used for public good to these companies. And whilst we lost on like the legal argument that it was unlawful for them to do that, the judge said that it was lawful for them to give tons of our public money to oil and gas companies, which I think we should be kind of outraged about. We were actually able to put this on public record by talking about it in and having it in a legal case. Because beforehand, the government had denied that there are these negative tax years. But in a court of law, they're forced to actually admit the truth. And so I think that it's we have to see everything as like it's a longer game than just like or a longer struggle than just what's happening right now. I think of, for example, with the Cambo oil field, that was an oil field that we managed to stop being approved. And that was only in 6 months we managed to make that happen. And that might seem like this like huge sudden win, but I see all these kind of movements as like mycelium, like mushrooms. So mycelium.
I know you have a thing for mushrooms.
Yeah, I do.
I do
because,
know
because it's amazing because mycelium is like millions of it is under the ground everywhere. Wherever we're walking around, we might not see it, but those connections are growing constantly and they're building. And then one day a mushroom will pop up somewhere and we'll think that was a miracle. That came out of nowhere. Oh my gosh, I've just found this amazing mushroom. But we don't see the mycelium that we're growing underground. And I think that that's how change happens. Really, it's like so many ordinary wonderful people are growing those mycelium networks underground. We might not see them, and one day there'll be a win that is like this amazing mushroom, but we have to be like willing to build the mycelium networks as well and not just be like focusing on the mushrooms.
Hopefully not get poisoned.
Yeah, exactly.
Keeping the mushroom analogy going. But you know, I know with some of your actions you took direct action, right? Which can really bug some people. Some people are really in favor of it, but whether it's, you know, tying yourself to a particular structure or getting in the way and some people would say stopping them getting to work or stopping emergency vehicles. And, you know, you do run the risk of alienating a substantial portion of the population that you're trying to convince to your way.
Mm-hmm. So the actions that I was involved with were always like very targeted at the government and and the oil and gas industry. So I was involved with blocking outside of the Department for Business, Energy and Industrial Strategy, so outside of Westminster Abbey. And that was to raise awareness of these kind of fossil fuel subsidies that we then later on took the government to court around. And in that instance, it was very focused. And I think that direct action has a place. And I think the place is it being focused on causing disruption to the right people and to the right targets. I think that if we look at past movements, like direct action has been a huge part of it. I'm a Jamaican British woman, my like right to vote in the UK was won by direct action by women. In I'm going to see Sylvia the Musical soon, very excited to learn more about that. And also my rights to be able to be free were fought by people in Jamaica who, by enslaved people who fought back. I think we get taught as if like the emancipation was handed down from above, and that did not happen. Like people had to fight for it. And so I think that it's important that we remember that direct action is an important tactic within that.
Emily's got in touch saying she's loving your voice and message. Before I let you go, you are a black woman in the climate justice world. Briefly, how is that?
It's not the easiest. There are too few of us, I think. And one of my greatest hopes with the work that I do is that I can inspire more people to know that, especially for the black community, we have the most to lose or the most to gain with how this crisis is tackled. The whole book is basically about the fact that the world as it is now, persevering or being preserved, is not the best that we can hope for. Climate justice actually offers us a world where like we can have a better world. It's not just about saving my birth country of Jamaica. It's about transforming the living conditions that people in Jamaica are able to live and of the diaspora, but also the majority of people. And so I think that there is so much that we, especially as black women, can bring to this movement and bring to this space, and our perspectives are so important. And so whilst I have had difficult times, there are also incredible groups that are starting up, like Black Girl Environmentalist and many others that are really championing for us, because we've been at the forefront of these movements for so many generations, and I'm glad that now people are starting to pay attention to our voices.
Michaela Loach, her new book, It's Not That Radical. Thanks so much for joining us on Woman's Hour.
Thank you for having me.
Now, I want to turn to women affected by the state pension age changes. They have scored what's been hailed as a major victory in the legal challenge for more compensation. The government watchdog conceded that part of the investigation into how increases to the state pension age were communicated, that it was flawed and must be reconsidered. It means the Parliamentary and Health Service Ombudsman, PHSO, conclusions about compensation for the affected women will also be considered. Now, the WASPI campaign, do you know what that stands for? The Women Against State Pension Inequality. They represent the 3.6 million women who, in lots of cases, got only 12 months' notice of a six-year increase to their state pension age. So you can imagine you've already decided you're not going to be working, and then this news comes through. I am joined by Angela Madden, who's the chair of WASPI. Welcome, Angela. How are you feeling this morning?
Fine, thank you, Lila.
Well, are you seeing it as a major victory?
We are, yes. It's at this stage in the process, if you like, it's the best that we could have hoped for. We'd taken a judicial review out against the Ombudsman's second report. And of course, if we had to wait for that to go to court, we might have been heard July maybe or September. Then it would have taken 2 months for the judge to bring down his judgment, us agreeing with the Ombudsman that the report is flawed and it can be rewritten. We've sort of saved a good 6 months off the process, I think.
Okay, and for people that are coming fresh to this story, you would have been impacted by this. Can you explain that for our listener?
Yes, it's women born in the 1950s. We were subject to the very first state pension age changes that the governments put in. It was decided in 1995. That women's state pension age would be equalised with men, so would go up to 65, and then they put both up to 66. All fine and good up to then, but they should have actually told us. They never informed us about changes to our state pension age until, like you say, sometimes 1 year, maybe 1.5 or 2 years before a great big hike. So even though the law was changed in 95, the first communications didn't go out until 2009. Now that's 14 years lost of opportunities for women like me to have saved, made some sort of difference, not taken some of the decisions we took thinking we were retiring at 60. And so that's what it's all about.
So what are you looking for exactly?
We're looking for compensation.
To the tune of?
Well, the government in total saved £200 billion by taking that pension away from women. And we're looking for some of that back. It's not up to us really to decide how much compensation, but each woman expected £40,000 or so on their state, on their pensions income that they just didn't get because the government decided they weren't going to get it. So the government really need to think about how much of that money is going to come back to us.
So they are going to review exactly the way their investigation was carried out, the PHSO. Where do you expect to go from here? How hopeful are you, and what sort of timeline are you looking at? Because I think that's really important. I was struck by one line that, you know, you have people that are in this fight that have died since this started.
Yes. One woman of our age dies every 13 minutes. So all this is about life expectancy increasing, but, you know, we're thinking, well, is it really? And there are some stalls now for people of our age, especially. But yes, we want to get it resolved as quickly as possible. We're hoping that that will be, the Ombudsman should start rewriting phase two report. Then he'll have to come up with a new remedies report, recommending that we should get compensation. So that should definitely, I think, be sorted out in the next 3 to 6 months. So perhaps by the end of this year, we should have it resolved. I mean, politicians, I think, really need to sit up and take notice. Mm. We've been fighting this campaign now for 7 years. I think they're all hoping we'll either die off or go away or shut up or get on with our knitting. Well, we're not going to. This is important to us. They need to walk in our shoes for a week or two, and then they'd know how important it was to us.
Angela Madden, the chair of WASPI, Women Against State Pension Inequality, thanks so much for coming on, and we will, of course, continue following your story. We did contact the Department for Work and Pensions for a statement. A spokesperson said the government decided 25 years ago it was going to make the state pension age the same for men and women. Both the High Court and the Court of Appeal have supported the actions of the DWP under successive governments dating back to 1995, and the Supreme Court refused the claimant's permission to appeal. Let us turn to a series we've been bringing you. Over the last couple of weeks, we've been talking about narcissistic mothers. You can catch up with those previous episodes via BBC Sounds. There's also an article about them on the Woman's Hour website. A narcissist is someone whose belief in their own importance causes them to act in a way that is damaging to others through controlling, being belittling, or manipulating behaviour. Now, Scarlett, not her real name, is 40. She took the decision to cut all communication with her mother after coming to the conclusion that the relationship was not what it should be. Enna Miller went to talk to Scarlett at her home and asked about her early life.
My childhood was very busy and chaotic. I grew up in a family with lots of siblings who were a fair bit older than me, and as time went on, I became the only person left in the household along with my parents.
The reason we're here is because you believe your mum is a narcissistic mother. So where does that come from?
That comes from starting to be treated very differently to my other siblings. I think it was because she maybe lost control of everyone else in the family because they were adults and I was the only person left that she could control. I feel as if there was a huge weight that I had to please her and I had to mediate and I had to carry out that role. I was also very, as I now know, parentified, and that means that I would carry out adult tasks. So I knew my parents' bank account number for a very young age, say around 10. I knew a lot of their personal information because I had neat writing, so I'd fill out all of their forms. I know children do chores, I understand that, but it would be like above and beyond. You know, I would do the ironing for like my siblings and my dad for us for the week, and I would get up in the morning to make sure our uniforms were dry. And I was about 12 or 13 at this point.
And they're all older than you?
Correct, yes. All of them are older than me, yes.
You said to me at one point you realised at a young age you had a funny relationship with your mum.
So I could tell you the mood that my mum would be in by the way that she wore her hair that day. I could tell you the footsteps of every single member of my family. You're on high alert constantly because you're ready to put yourself in survival mode. A very standout moment for me was when I was 14. I had gone with my mum to visit siblings. And my mum very much didn't like the fact that I was spending time with them and not her. She took me on my own and she took me around the back of a supermarket and she called me a bitch. And that's when I realised that there was something different about my relationship with her.
what was going on in your head?
There was a lot of confusion, but I never actually questioned it, though. I just went along with it because my mum told me I was something, and there's an implicitness with your parents, isn't there, that you just believe it. It made me think that I was a terrible person.
Is it still in your head?
Yes, 100%.
Describe how you felt when you were younger in 5 words.
Definitely felt guilty. Responsible. Worthless, very much felt worthless. And anxious. Very anxious as a teenager, incredibly anxious.
What was the guilt you were feeling?
I think the guilt and the responsibility are very much linked. I always felt guilty that, even as a child, that maybe I wasn't doing enough to, like, contribute to the family. There's an instance that I can remember where I had a purple bowling bag for Christmas that I had chosen, and then I really, really liked it. I thought it was the business. And my mum would always go on about how nice it was and how lovely it was. And in the end, I relented and gave it to her because I thought, well, she thinks it's so nice, it'll make her happy. I'll give it to her. And I felt guilty for having it, and she didn't. And she ruined it. Yeah. And she ruined it. So the guilt and the obligation there, the guilt that I felt that she didn't have the purple bag, and then the obligation from me to give it to her.
And she took it.
And she took it. She didn't say, oh, no. It wasn't, oh, no. And it wasn't even, oh, we'll share. Or
just... How old were you?
17.
Right.
Another one is, as a family, went through a period where money was very, very, very tight. I mean incredibly tight. But my mum used to enjoy, she would enjoy going out on a Friday night with her friends. So I would save up my dinner money, and then on the Friday, I'd go, here's the money that I saved up from the week for my dinner money for you to go out. But again, she didn't say no. She didn't say you shouldn't have done it. She went out and she took it and went out.
And being devil's advocate, mm-hmm. was it all to do with your mother? Or was that the personality that you had developed also contributed to this? Do you see what I'm trying to say?
I know what you're saying. I think it's very much taking advantage of someone's kind nature.
So where were your siblings when all this was happening?
One of my siblings had a family. Another sibling was at university. Other siblings, because of their age, they'd moved out. So they weren't there anyway. And then my other siblings were just out with friends. And I was in the house on my own.
Did no one confide in each other?
No, it was never spoken about. That's how I was treated. And that's it.
And where was your father?
My dad worked a lot. And then when he was home, it was just very much the traditional, he'd get in, have his tea, watch telly, go to bed. My mum walked me to school until the day I left at 18. My mum would know our lunch times. But she would turn up at the exact time I would be outside the chip shop eating my chips with my friends. You know, she'd interfere, like, in conversations.
So what would she do? She would just slide along and say hi?
It would be a, oh, God, there's Scarlett's mum. And she would come up and she'd be like, well, I read your lips. And you said, oh, God, there's Scarlett's mum. And then I would then feel awkward. So she was eliminating them from my life because they wouldn't want to hang out with me, shall we say, because Scarlett's mum meets her for lunch.
So control was huge for you?
Yes, as a teenager, and that has impacted me for the rest of my life.
In what way?
That I ended up in a controlling relationship that I had to leave. Thinking control is love. So thinking how my mum controlled me because she was my mum, that was love. So when I was looking for a partner, that's what I would associate. So I would associate control with love, and then it's impacted everything in regards to personal relationships since.
That's huge.
Yeah, absolutely. And it took a while to recognise that's what it is and was.
You didn't have children because of what you went through?
Correct.
Why?
Because I didn't want to have children and turn into my mum and have the behaviours of my mum and project that onto any children that I may have had. because if I did that and realised that I'd done it, I'd be devastated, and I would never want to put any child through what I went through.
Talking about the cutting off.
Yes.
What was the moment?
The moment was a takeaway. So I ordered a takeaway for me and my mum because she'd been feeling poorly. Bearing in mind this is my mum's absolute favourite takeaway in the entire world, she just sat there and went, this is disgusting. And it was that point that I was like, I don't want to speak to her ever again. And I never did. She was attacking my kindness in that situation. And I was like, I don't need you to do that anymore. That was it. That was like, yeah, I'm done. Yeah, and I know it sounds... No, I'm not going to validate it by saying it sounds trivial, because it doesn't, but it just takes one thing, doesn't it, for people to go, that's it, yeah, no more.
And you took your cardie with you and left?
Correct.
Birthdays, Christmases came and went. Mother's Day?
Yeah, it is an adjustment, but I'm quite stubborn, so I'm just like, well, I'm just going to get through it. Then, aren't I?
Were you devastated?
No, there was no sadness in it at all.
I feel like I want you to be devastated. There's something about a mother.
I get why you want me to be devastated. I get that. She wasn't a mum to me anyway. If you really listen to what I've just said, that's not what a mum does, is it? That's not a mum's behaviour. So I wasn't devastated at all.
Have you grieved?
Yes. That was a big process. And it was important to do it as well. Grieving the loss of the mum that I never had but wanted.
You're still in contact with your siblings.
Yeah.
Are they on eggshells? Are they like, oh, sorry, can't mention mum. What? How does it work?
They will talk about mum. And I'm like, well, that's okay, because she's still part of their life. If I don't want to be part of the conversation or don't want the conversation, I will ask them to stop, or I'll remove myself from the situation.
What was their reaction when you turned up and... you said, our mum's a narcissist.
Each sibling is different. Some of them have just acknowledged that that's how I feel about her. We don't really talk about it. And that's okay. It's not a dismissal. It's a just, that's how you've dealt with it. You don't talk to her. I talk to her. Fine. One sibling argued it and said it wasn't true, and that she can't have been abusive because she was our mum. And because I don't want to force anything onto people, because it's my journey and my trauma, should we say, I've gone, all right, okay, I know that you don't understand.
How is she? Has she reached out to you? Has she asked you what's going on? What's been the communication?
The communication is that she's tried to contact me via family members. Gifts, birthday cards, Christmas cards, Christmas presents. What she did once, which really shocked me, because I blocked her via the phone, and because I'm not on social media, she wouldn't be able to find me that way. She actually borrowed someone else's phone and rang me off their number. And because I didn't know who it was, I answered. I felt violated because she had gone to such great lengths to get in contact with me, even though the boundary was there for her to not contact me.
Like, my eyes are, like, just popping because you feel violated. And in my head, I think, God, she's really making an effort to reach out. Isn't that love?
No. No, I'd have to massively disagree with that. It felt very manipulative.
And is the door ever open? Is this it for the rest of her life, your life?
Absolutely, yeah.
You seem to be thriving.
Yeah, thank you, yeah. It's okay to not have people in your life that don't support you or that aren't your cheerleaders or treat you the way that, like, my mum treated me. And it was the best thing that I ever did. Just because they're your mum or your dad or your caregiver or whatever, if they're not a nice person, you don't need them in your life.
Do you meet other people who've experienced the same thing as you?
No, that's not something that I want to do, because for me, this isn't competitive. So I don't actively seek this out. I know a lot of people go on to groups, and that's just not my thing. I'm dealing with this the best way for me.
Because it's quite trendy. You're nodding in agreement.
Like, a worry of mine is that because it is so trendy at the moment, and I think people are throwing around the word narcissist like confetti right now, but they're not really understanding what it means. I am worried that the whole trendiness around it invalidates the people who have suffered at the hands of like a narcissistic parent. It is a heavy word, so to make light of it, I don't think is the best thing.
And of course, that is Anna Miller speaking to Scarlett, not her real name. And as we've made clear, the stories we've heard so far have been from the point of view of the daughters involved. We have been contacted by some listeners who've been labelled a narcissist by their children, and they've been devastated by it. So that's a part of this story as well that we want to talk about. So if it's your experience, we'd love to hear from you. The text is 84844, or you can email us through our website. Let me see. Fiona texted us. She said, "I cannot thank you enough for highlighting the issue of narcissistic mothers. Mine threatened suicide when she needed attention. That went on for nearly 30 years. When I finally raised it with a friend for the first time at 40 years old, it was life-changing. She died last year and completely cut me out of her will because I finally broke the spell. It has felt taboo for years. Thank you, thank you, thank you." And thank you, Fiona, for getting in touch. Now, if you're a regular listener to Woman's Hour, you might remember that at the end of last year, we spoke to Jackie Moulton. She'd maybe best known for being the real life inspiration behind the character of DCI Jane Tennyson in Prime Suspect. She broke down gender barriers in policing and now has two master's degrees and an honorary doctorate. But despite all that, she's still upset that she failed her 11 plus exam. And she says it impacted her decades on. This morning, we're speaking to someone who had a rejection also in their youth, but and had impact for decades, but in a good way. I was asking you if you ever had a rejection that was a blessing in disguise. Text 84844. Here's a couple of messages I saw. Let me see. This is Hillary. "I was rejected from all five of my university choices in 1976. I ended up going to the newly established drama course in Aberystwyth and met my husband, Ian. He might be surprised to hear that that was the best thing to happen to me. And we're happily together for nearly 44 years. Here's Sarah. "When I was at school, I was desperate to be a physiotherapist, but rejected due to poor A-level results. So I went into nursing. It was the best thing that happened to me. I loved every minute of it. Here's to poor A-level results." Exclamation point. I can see my guest, Alison Kinnaird, is smiling at that. She was rejected by Edinburgh Art School when she applied. She's now one of the leading glass engravers in the world and has been commissioned, among many other things, to make a wedding present for the then Prince Charles and Lady Diana Spencer. Her art currently features in the permanent collection of the Scottish Parliament and Royal Collections. She does say that getting rejected was the best thing that ever happened to her. Why, Alison, and welcome.
Nice to be with you. Yes, I'm sure it was the best thing because, you know, when you're at school, all the life choices are not presented to you. You're certainly not aware of all the different avenues you could take at that point. And I knew definitely that I wanted to do something creative. You know, I was very good at art at school. I was always making things. My art teachers were very encouraging. Mr. and Mrs. Henderson were lovely to me. So I think of them very fondly. And when I sat the entrance test for Edinburgh Art College and was rejected, it certainly was a bit of a blow. You know, it was unexpected. And I really didn't know what I wanted to do after that.
But you went to a studio, I believe, in Forres that kind of began to put you on this other path that has, of course, made you a world-class glass engraver.
Well, in between that, I mean, I went to, I decided to pursue the other subjects that I was interested in. So I did, I started a degree in Celtic studies and archaeology instead. And that was fascinating, but doesn't really qualify you for anything. And when I was on holiday up in the north of Scotland in Forres, it was a wet day and there was a little article in the local paper about a glass engraver's studio that was open. And my family and I said, "Oh, well, let's go and see what this guy does." And it was a lovely man called Harold Gordon. And he saw some drawings that I'd been doing while I was on holiday and said, "You know, these would look good in glass. Why don't you come and work with me for the summer?" And that was how I started off being introduced to glass. And I think that many artists and craftspeople are drawn to one particular medium.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly I had never thought of, entering anything to do with glass. So to be introduced to it by a lovely man called Harold Gordon, who was a terrific glass engraver himself, he just introduced me to the potential that was there to express yourself in a completely different way.
You know, one piece I found really striking, some people might know it, it's called Unknown. It's a glass army lit up with these LED structures as well as you place them. And it kind of gives you an idea of the innovation, the imagination that you were able to bring to glass engraving. Where do those ideas come from?
Well, the engraving itself, what I do is copper wheel engraving, and that's a really ancient technique. I mean, you wouldn't believe it, but the Babylonians used something similar.
Wow.
We just have an electric motor now to power the little lathe that drives the spindles with wheels on them that we use. And so it's a very old technique, but you can use modern technology in conjunction with it. And I've found that introducing light into my work has been very, very important because it really shows up the engraving for a start, but you can see a lot of different things with it. And that glass army was a piece that I produced myself. It was really to talk about how fragile life is in time of war. And glass seemed the ideal medium to comment on that. It's comprised of about 60 figures. Some of them are soldiers, most of them are soldiers, and then some are civilian figures as well, because war doesn't just affect the military. It toured around Scotland. It started off in the Scottish Parliament and then went to about 25 different venues, including National Trust properties and so on.
You know, when you look up your name, Alison, of course the engraving comes up, but also, you know, that you're this huge exponent of the Scottish harp as well. Some people might be wondering how you are so multi-talented, and also what was Edinburgh Art School doing rejecting you. But apart from that, that's a number of decades down the line. You've obviously done wonderful in your career. Do you gravitate towards the music or the engraving, or is it all part of the same expression of your, I suppose, artistic abilities?
Well, the two things have kind of run parallel throughout my life. And I mean, I was lucky because I fell quite by accident into two areas which were really quite neglected, you know, when I started playing Scottish harp, because I loved the music, you know, traditional music is my thing. There were maybe six people playing the harp in Scotland in public, and that's changed completely now. I mean, the harp scene is very, very wide in Scotland. There's a lot of people playing and a number of harp makers who are very busy making harps. So that's nice to see that. In contrast to that, engraving is dying out. We're on the red list of endangered crafts. Because wheel engraving is one of those things that's not being taught at art colleges, well, and it's just dying out.
It's so sad to hear that. I am going to point people to an article on you, Alison Kinnaird, which is on the BBC website so they can learn a little bit more about the skills that you have. And who knows, sometimes these things do get a revival if people point out that they are on the way out. I want to thank you so much for joining us today on Woman's Hour. That's all for today's Woman's Hour. Join us again next time.
Hello, I'm Lucy Worsley, and I want to tell you about Lady Killers from BBC Radio 4. It's a programme that mixes true crime with history, but with a twist. With our all-female team of experts, I am re-examining the crimes committed by murderesses in the past through the eyes of 21st century feminists. What can we learn from these women, and would it be any different today? Lady Killers. Listen first on BBC Sounds.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hi, I'm Graham Class, host of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. Join me for season two as we explore the future of technology evolving today. In each episode, I'll speak with the minds transforming medicine, healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Join me every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.